Okay. In Stardust is a list of all the occultations that's occurring for the next month or so. Is David Dunham here? Are there any other announcements for the good of the order? When is the next Mid-Atlantic Seniors meeting, Jack? We having a meeting in September? Jack?
Yes.
And tell us about it.
Okay, just a minute. The talk will be given by Larry Nittler from the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism of the Carnegie Institution for Science. But actually, it will be given by his wife. He injured his finger and is going to have an operation. And the title is A Cometary Fossil and an Asteroid and an Asteroidal Meteorite.
What day?
I'm sorry. That is Wednesday, September 16 at 1 p.m.
That's next week.
That's next week. The talks are usually on the third Wednesday at 1 p.m. There is a link to the Zoom meeting in the calendar of events on page 7 of the Stardust.
Are there any other announcements that need to be made before I introduce our excellent vice president who will introduce the speaker? Okay, Dr. Hornstein, you're on now. So go ahead and unmute yourself and introduce our excellent speaker.
John, for some reason we can't hear you.
Yeah, we can't.
You're not muted.
Okay. So talk, John.
Your headphones aren't working.
Well, if worse comes to worse, I suppose I can introduce the speakers since I have Stardust on my iPad here. So Tommy Wicklund from Catholic University of America is going to speak today on the evolution of galaxies over cosmic time. I remind you that annual dues are due. Mine was actually picked up by the postman today, so it'll take a few days before it gets to Henry Bowfinger. He studied mathematics and physics at the University of Gothenburg, as well as astronomy at the University of Lund. And he received his PhDs from Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, using millimeter wave radio telescopes to study molecular interstellar regions nearby galaxies, followed by a postdoc in Paris. And then he returned to Sweden and the European Space Agency and the part based anyway. And then he joined ALMA, so he's been all over the globe, and now he's a research professor at Catholic University of America. And so now I think maybe we ought to turn it over to our excellent speaker, since our vice president's microphone evidently wasn't working.
Okay, so I'll start here. Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's very nice to be here, even if it would have been even nicer if we could all have been meeting in person, of course. So I will be presenting a talk here today that, let me see if I can get this to share the PowerPoint. And I need to switch this. I'm sorry, it shared the wrong screen. I'll try it again. This is funny.
Do you need to do that swap displays at the top?
Yeah, but I can't find the swap display.
Oh, you're to the left there, back. Stop, go back a little bit more to the left, and there it is.
I don't see it. It says...
We see it.
Okay. oh, there we go. It was hidden. Okay, here we go. Sorry about that. Let me get why this ended up here. I don't know. Okay, so let's get started now. So the title of my talk here is The Evolution of Galaxies Over Cosmic Time. And it's a very wide subject in a sense, and it covers a lot of both space and time. And I will try to keep this within a reasonable time. So I'd like to start with the first slide is a fairly simple looking plot, but the amount of work that has gone into this over the last 20 or almost 25 years is actually quite tremendous. And what it shows is something called the star formation rate density as a function of redshift or as a function of cosmic time. And here to the right is somewhere is Big Bang, and on the left here we have today. And what the star formation rate density shows is basically the number of stars that are formed per year per unit volume. And this has changed by quite a large factor. So if you look at this scale, it's logarithmic numbers. So we are here today. This is the activity that is going on right now. But if we go back in time, this increases by more than a factor of 10, actually almost a factor of 20. And then it goes down again. And then we get in fewer and fewer points here because it gets increasingly difficult to do these observations. But the amount of time that has really gone into this and the number of teams and astronomers that have worked on this is tremendous. But what it's telling us is that there have been immense changes in the universe during its existence. And it continues to change today. And in fact, if we look at what kind of activity level we are at today, that would be the same as if we go out to a redshift of almost 7. Now, I will come back to this later, but a redshift of 7 means that we are looking at an epoch which is somewhere around 500 and 600 million years after the Big Bang. So it's very, very early in the universe. But if we look at the local universe, and when we say the local universe, we mean within the few, say, or say within 100 million parsecs from us. Then we can actually look at these galaxies in detail. We can study them, both what kind of stars they have, even if we can't always resolve the stars, we can see what kind of gas and dust they have, like this antennae galaxies. And we tend to look at things that are bright and forming stars like the antennae, but we also have these elliptical galaxies that we just saw. Here's another interacting spiral galaxy, beautiful HST images. And the fact is that we can divide galaxies into two main types, and I'm pretty sure you all knew this. So we have the spiral galaxies, so we'll call them disk galaxies. They are flattened, they have a bulge, and quite often spiral arms, like this image of M83. There are young stars mixed in with old stars. There's dust, there's interstellar gas, and star formation are going on, meaning that there are new stars forming all the time. And on the right, we have elliptical galaxies. They are spheroidal, that is almost not quite spherical, but they're spheroidal. The stars in these are on radial orbits rather than in circular orbits like in disk galaxies. There is very little dust or interstellar gas in these, and therefore also very little star formation going on. So they contain quite old stars, and no new ones are forming. So if we look in the local universe and try to count So where are most of the stars? And this turns out to be a fairly tricky question, but it seems that the majority of all stars in the local universe actually resides in spheroidal galaxies. And depending on if you stop this at an S0 or a pure elliptical, you get up to about 75%, which is remarkable. The reason for this is that the elliptical galaxies tend to be very massive, much more massive than spiral galaxies. And in fact, our Milky Way and also M31 are a little bit unusual in the sense that we do live in a fairly massive galaxy, but it is a disk galaxy, a spiral galaxy. Most of them are less massive than the Sun, or than the Milky Way. So almost 100 years ago, a little less than that, Edwin Hubble came up with a classification scheme of galaxies. He studied galaxies, he looked at their shapes, and he came up with this Hubble fork diagram, where it goes from elliptical galaxies to lenticular galaxies, and then you progressively go into more disk galaxies, spiral galaxies. And he had two branches for that. One is for barred galaxies, spiral galaxies, and one for non-barred spiral galaxies. And this turned out to be a very nice classification, because there are properties of the galaxies that change as you go from, say, elliptical over to spiral galaxies. For instance, these galaxies, as I mentioned, the ellipticals are gas poor, whereas the spirals, as you go along here, are increasingly more gas rich. That also means that these are sort of dead in terms of forming new stars, whereas the spiral galaxies are still forming stars. They tend to be more massive, and as you go along here, galaxies tend to be less massive. But if we look at the so the ellipticals are only consisting of old stars, and for spiral galaxies, you have also the old stars, but also young stars. These are the ones that are being formed. So if we look in the high redshift universe, the early universe, we don't find these Hubble type galaxies as we do in the local universe. And this is an image of, this is the Hubble ultra deep field. It's one of the deepest, or the deepest image ever taken. It's a very small part of the sky. This is only 2.5 by 2.5 arc minutes. So it's like a tenth of the full moon. But still, it contains about 10,000 galaxies. This spiral galaxy, by the way, is one that was from an epoch when the Sun was formed, a redshift of 0.4 or 0.45. But most of these galaxies don't look like the galaxies we have in the local universe. They are clumpy, they're irregular, they look distorted, or as one famous colleague of mine once said, they all look like train wrecks, pretty much. So the question is, what is happening here? How do we go from galaxies that look like this to the left to these beautifully structured galaxies that we have in the local universe? That turns out to be a fairly complicated question that has astronomers have wrestled with for quite a while now. So the funny thing is that we know pretty well what happened a very long time ago, say 300,000 years after the Big Bang, the last scattering surface where we can measure the cosmic microwave background. And that has been done, the first time was almost 28 years ago with COBE. And then we've had WMAC and Planck and several ground-based experiments that have been observing this cosmic microwave background and the fluctuation. We can fit the fluctuation power spectrum and get a lot of cosmological parameters out of that. And that was a very minute unevenness sort of in the matter distribution. And then we fast forward 13.8 billion years, and we're in the today and our local universe where we can study these galaxies like M81 and M82 here, where we have large density fluctuations in the ordinary matter baryonic. We have stars, neutron stars, black holes, and we also have large scale structures, which is we have galaxies, we have groups of galaxies and clusters, and so on. But how we go from here to here is still being studied. One thing that changes that we can measure is what astronomers call the metallicity. Now, metallicity is very different from what a chemist would call metals. This is the periodic table of elements, which is not something one can easily remember, but for astronomers, it's very easy. So we have that the everything that is not helium and hydrogen are metals, we call it, which basically means that anything that is formed in stars is metal. So if you have no star formation, you will only have helium and hydrogen. But if you form stars, a certain fraction of the process gas will eventually make it out in the interstellar medium and then take part in future star formation. And by building up this generation of stars, the amount of metals increases. So that is one way of studying the evolution. And very roughly, when we say metal rich, means that it's about the solar type of metallicity or greater, and metal poor if it's less than solar. So talking about the Milky Way, so the Milky Way is an interesting example. It's a, as I said, a disk galaxy. It consists of a bulge in the center with old stars. There's some dust and gas there as well. It has a thin disk with gas, dust, and a mixture of old and young stars, and that is where all of the star formation is going on right now. But it also has a halo consisting of old stars, and some of them are as old as the universe itself. So that means that they must have formed in these very, very early redshift 6, 7 or higher. And then it's surrounded by a system of globular clusters, which are also of old stars, but a slightly different ages, actually, which is interesting. So in a sense, it's a fairly simple system. And there were three gentlemen. This is Alden Eggen, Donald Lindenbell, and Alan Sandage, shown here in the photograph, published a paper back in 1962 where they could explain the formation of our galaxy. But they looked at the kinematics of the stars, and they came up with that this was consistent with that the Milky Way started out as a large primordial gas cloud, and that was self-gravitating, meaning that it was collapsing. It had a little bit of angular momentum, so it was spinning. And if you start forming stars during the collapse, you could form this halo of stars, but you would also end up with a disk and then continue star formation in this disk. So it was a very nice theory and or model of the formation of our Milky Way, and it proposed that it was formed about 10 billion years ago or slightly more. The problem was that it doesn't work out in the end, it turns out, with especially for the globular clusters who have different ages, and there are a bunch of problems that arose once we got more observational data. And of course, at that time, they did not include dark matter. And it turns out what drives the formation of structure in the universe is not the things that we can observe. It's not stars or gas and things like that, baryons. But it's driven by this dark matter, which exists at a level of about 5 to 6 times more than ordinary matter. So by following the formation or the evolution of the dark matter, we get a better picture of the large scale structure in the universe than observing stars, actually. And we can actually do numerical simulations of this, like what went into these three cubes here, showing at the distant universe, sort of middle and at low C or in the local universe. And you see that it's more clumped, there are filaments that have been created and so on. And this is actually something that can be modeled fairly well. So, because the dark matter, as far as we know, only interacts through gravity. And it doesn't have any electromagnetic interaction or any other type of exchange of energy with itself or ordinary matter. So it's only gravity. And this is fairly linear things. We can put that in a computer and make numerical models. And we do have the initial conditions. That's the cosmic microwave background. And this means that we can see what happens with these little clumps of matter from an amplitude of 100,000th of a fluctuation until today's large scale structure like galaxies and galaxy groups and clusters. And you end up with this kind of tree where you start out with small structures at the distant universe, and they merge together or fall through these filaments, and they become bigger and bigger, and they grow as with time. So this is known as a merger tree. What is complicated is when we put in the ordinary matter, the baryons, because the baryons can follows the dark matter. If you have a gravitational potential because of a clump of dark matter, the baryons will fall into that one. But baryons can cool, they can interact with each other in electromagnetically. And that means that you get a very nonlinear physics and things can get quite messy and it gets difficult to model it. It gets complex. So we have the numerical simulation, which are fairly well understood. We have the star formation and we have the feedback, which means that if you form a compact object like a star, it will give back energy into the surroundings that will influence how you form stars from that gas in the future. So this gives us the observed universe. So we know the observed universe, we know the numerical simulations quite well, but this is the problematic one. So I'm going to show you a numerical simulation, a cosmological simulation done with the Illustris group. This is, again, a collaboration of many different institutes. And it will show a cube of about 10 by 10 by 10 megaparsec. So that would be almost 15 times the distance between us and M31. So it's a fairly large part of space. And we follow it from very high redshift where things are very smooth. And you will see two images. One will show the dark matter. And it just evolves very slowly, very regularly. And the other is they try to put in this messy physics, and you will see the gas temperature, and you will see how it blooms. Let me start this illustration, so we can see how the gas temperature here, once you start forming stars, and especially when you start introducing supermassive black holes and have active galactic nuclei and quasars, they will give feedback to the surrounding gas and actually heat it up. So this is now a redshift of about 3. We are 2 billion years after the Big Bang. It moves fairly quickly. And you can now start seeing quasars and AGNs heating up gas in where these filament meets, which means that you have a big galaxy there. At least according to this simulation, the effect can be quite intense. It can be quite strong on the surrounding gas. And that means probably that it inhibits further star formation or make it more difficult to form stars again. But it's this process, which is not really put in as a little bit of an ad hoc parameters in this simulation, because we don't have the resolution that we can actually model the large scale structure and the formation of, say, a black hole or stars on that scale yet. So now we're coming down to an epoch where our sun was formed, and we can see that the amount of heated gas in this cube, 10 by 10 by 10 megaparsec, is actually quite impressive. We also see that they note stellar mass here. It starts out at zero, and because basically a galaxy is a machine that turns gas into stars, right? So we start with zero, and then you build up more and more stars as time goes on. And now we're getting pretty much into the what we call the local universe, and then the simulation stops here. So this is, as I said, a collaboration of several institutes and universities, and it's one of the best numerical simulations that we have around right now. So before going on, I just wanted to talk a little bit about redshift and time and things like that, because I've been using, and I will continue to talk about redshift and also about time, and there's a nonlinear relationship between redshift and time. So redshift is a measure of what we call the scale factor. The universe, according to the Big Bang theory, started as a hot, dense place, and one would like to think of it as a small, but it's not that that is a small part of the universe. It was the universe itself was small, and we measure this as a scale factor. So it's like we have the coordinate system itself is growing in size with time. That is the cosmic expansion. So here at the Big Bang, the scale factor, which we have on the y-axis here, is zero. Here we are today, the scale factor is one, say. And if you put in the dark matter and dark energy, then you get its evolution that goes pretty much like this. Now, the redshift is, as I said, a nonlinear. If we go to redshift of one, which is about 8 billion years ago, so here's time is zero, Big Bang is 13.8 billion years, so redshift of one corresponds to about almost 8 billion years. And redshift of two, we're up to 10 billion years. Redshift of four, we're talking 12 billion years, which means that we're only 1.8 billion years after the Big Bang itself. And today, astronomers are able to observe things up to redshift of almost 10. And that means that we're getting into very, very close to the Big Bang, just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang itself. So I mentioned before, if you remember this beautiful spiral galaxy in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, that was actually at the redshift of 0.46, if I remember correctly. And that is about the time that is 4.5 billion years ago, which is when the epoch when the sun and the earth and our solar system was formed. So we were formed in this era right here, when the scale factor was about 0.7, and today it's one. So having said this, if we want to study high redshift galaxies, first of all, how do we find them? How do we tell that a galaxy is very distant? And one way is, of course, to if we can take a spectrum and identify lines, either emission lines or absorption lines, and see how they are redshifted, because they're redshifted because of the expansion of the universe. Now, that works for some cases, but actually very, very few. And in terms of time, if you want to observe this as an astronomer, if you have to go to someone and ask for time, they're going to say, well, that's too expensive. You will spend hours and hours just to get one single galaxy. That's not going to work. So instead, people are using, well, basically two different techniques, which relies on the same principle. And that is that if you take a galaxy consisting of a few hundred billion stars, some gas and dust, it will actually look different if you look at it in different wavelengths. Here's an illustration of this. It's M51. This is a compilation that was made by a group of people who ran a website for a few years, but that is unfortunately defunct right now. So if you look at M51 in X-rays, you're seeing a hot ionized gas and some compact objects, accreting objects like these little dots here. These are probably stellar black hole remnants. If you look in the ultraviolet, you see young and massive stars. These are what we call O stars or B stars. And notice here that the companion that we have here that is visible in the optical and even in the X-ray is essentially gone here, which one can interpret that there are no young stars in the companion. This is the optical where you see both stars, both young and a little older. You see ionized gas, you start seeing the effect of dust as well. The near infrared, so this is say between 1 and 5 micron, you'll see the old stars. These are stars that have been around for a long time, and you can see that the M51 is much more regular in appearance than if you compare with the UV, which has only the young stars. If you go to the far infrared, which is not shown here, you will actually see the dust distribution that shines by re-radiating absorbed stellar radiation. And then if you go to even longer wavelength into centimeter wavelength, you see radio continuum, and then you start seeing ionized gas again. And that could come from either thermal emission or synchrotron. Synchrotron comes when charged particles spirals in a magnetic field. So depending on the wavelength, you see different things. And that can be used to actually derive properties from galaxies without taking a spectra. You if you can observe it using broadband filters, you can go much deeper in a short time than if you're trying to take a spectra. In a sense, you're doing a very crude spectra with very poor resolution. And there are a few things that the basic two steps to identify a high redshift galaxy. One is known as the dropout technique. And it comes from the fact that if you, at one point, you have what's called the Lyman limit, and that is that photons with shorter wavelengths than this have energies enough to ionize hydrogen. And hydrogen is the most common element in the universe, which means that they have a high probability of being absorbed even before they leave the star, actually, where the photons originate. So very little of that radiation reaches us. But once they have an energy that is not enough to ionize hydrogen, they are free to escape, or fairly free to escape. Oops. And then the galaxy comes up here. So we have a break. It's called the Lyman break at a given wavelength. So if you observe with a filter this selects a wavelength range that you will take an image on, like this image, you will actually not see the galaxy because it's too faint. And then an adjacent filter will be on the long wavelength of this break, and then the galaxy will pop up like this. And that means that this wavelength, where the break is, will be somewhere in between here. And this can be used then to see how redshifted it is. And sometimes this can be quite redshifted. It it's illustrated here. This is another galaxy. This is Hubble data, where this is a B band, or so it's a blue visceral. Then we're getting into the red optical, and here we are into the near infrared. We're going to up towards the mid infrared wavelengths, and there's nothing here in BVI and Z, which is optical. It starts popping up something in the J band, which is 1.1 micron wavelength, observed wavelength, I should say. So that means that this break is somewhere between here and here. And from that, one can deduce that the redshift of this galaxy must be 5 or more. And the more filters you have, the more exact you can do this. The other way of doing that is to say, well, I can generate a synthetic spectral energy distribution for a galaxy by assuming that there is a number of stars that are formed, and then letting it evolve, and then see, try to fit a curve like this with to a few points that comes from the observations. And this illustrates, if you have one population of stars that is born, and then 50 million years later, the spectra will look like this. This is the break here that doesn't change. 100 million year, 200 million year. And we see that the massive stars are dying off, and it gets fainter and fainter at the ultraviolet and blue wavelengths. And that would give you not only the redshift, but it would also give you things like the stellar mass, the extinction, you can even have the age and things like that. So it is a much cheaper way of getting properties of galaxies than taking spectra, which takes forever to actually get for a single galaxy. So this is what drives things like the deep fields. So a deep field is where you take a telescope, like in this case, the Hubble telescope, you select a part of the sky or several parts of the sky, and you image that part in as many filters as you can and as deep as you can. And then you can identify a given galaxy in all the different filters, and you can do this spectral synthesis or just do the dropout technique. And I've been part of this, which is called the CANDLES. I should get back to that, which stands for the Cosmic Assembly and Near Infrared Deep Extragalactic Legacy Survey. And it got almost 900 orbits with Hubble spread over 4 cycles, and has been very, very productive in trying to understand how galaxies evolve. The problem with looking at how things evolve, though, with the time or with redshift, is that how do you select a galaxy? How do you link descendants and progenitors? Say, let's say that you have a galaxy like the Milky Way, or a galaxy of the same stellar mass as our galaxy. If you want to see, and we can determine how much dust we have, how much gas, and other properties, then you would like to compare that with what happened with the Milky Way progenitor, say 10 billion years ago, which would put us at redshift 2, or maybe we want to go out to 12 billion years and so on. And this is a plot that just shows the logarithm of the stellar mass measured in solar masses versus redshift for all the galaxies in the CANDLES fields. So there are almost 200,000 galaxies here. We simply don't know. So some of these galaxies will evolve to be different galaxies in the local universe, and some will evolve to this. The only thing we know, and this we know from these merger trees, that the dark matter halos, they grow by merging together, by falling into each other. So it's likely to assume that the stellar mass is lower at higher redshift than it is today. And that also comes from the fact that as you go to higher redshift, more of a galaxy's mass is in gas, and then this gas is processed into stars. So there is a way to do this, though, that we used for 2 hour studies, and I hope to get to that studies before I run out of time, where you can actually link the descendants and the progenitors. And it's a method developed by two groups, one led by Master and one by Barossi, and others, and has been quite successful. And a quick description of that is that it combines observations of stars with observations of these numerical simulations of dark matter halos. So we can take the simulations of dark matter halos, and at a given redshift, we can determine how many dark matter halos there is of a given halo mass, and you get what's called a mass function. Now we can also measure the same thing with a lot of observing time and a lot of effort for galaxies, and then we get the stellar mass function. So we know, and if we assume then that these are related to each other, so if we see n number of galaxies at a given redshift of a given mass, then we should have n number that should correspond to n numbers of dark matter halos. So you actually get a relation between a ratio between the stellar mass and the dark matter mass as a function of either halo mass or stellar mass, and as a function of redshift. And this is plotted here, and this is for redshift zero, and you can see it changes. This is the halo mass, this is the ratio of the stellar and the halo mass. It has a peak, and then it falls off on both sides. If you go to a higher redshift, so the red one here is redshift one, it's very different, and in green it shifts again, and so on and so on. So this is something that changes with time, but what this does is that it allows us to identify a galaxy today of a given stellar mass and see who were the galaxies at higher redshift, who are the likely progenitors. And if you take the fact that there is a scatter in this merging history of dark matter halos into account, you get this slice in stellar mass and redshift space. And what this is saying is this is for five different galaxies. This is a galaxy approximately like the same mass as our Milky Way. And this is slightly lower mass. The red one here goes down to about the Large Magellanic Cloud type of galaxy. So then we can say that the likely progenitors of our galaxy is somewhere in this purple slice here. It overlaps with the next one because there is this scatter and uncertainty. And the reason this is very nice and that we have pursued it is that the only selection criteria you're using here is stellar mass, which you get from doing this synthetic stellar spectra and fitting them to observed data, and the redshift. So by picking galaxies in one of these slices, we can look at the evolutionary effects or pure evolutionary effects. So we've done this for two different things. We've done it for morphology, to see how that changes. We've done it for how much gas there is in the galaxy, or the gas fraction. So morphology is the most problematic one because, as I said before, at high redshift, we don't have this nice Hubble classification scheme. They look like train wrecks, pretty much. They're clumpy, they're small, and also the further out they go, the more difficult it gets to actually see them or do morphology. But there is one thing that I didn't mention before, which is the light distribution. So the light distribution of elliptical galaxies is very different from the disk of spiral galaxies. And the elliptical galaxies have what's known as a divacular profile, which is a very, very concentrated in the center, and then it goes out slowly. And an exponential is an exponential like this. So this is illustrated here. The red one is the Vaucouleurs profile of an elliptical galaxy, and this is an exponential for the disk galaxy. This can be parameterized, what's known as a Sirsik index. And this is the functional form that you can write. Sirsik was an Argentinian astronomer back in the more than 50 years ago, came up with this. So this n number here, if n is 1, we get an exponential profile. If n is 4, we get something which is essentially a de Vaucouleurs profile. So if we go from here to here, Sirsik index goes from 4 to about 1. And the light distribution is something that we actually can measure in these high redshift galaxies. So we can get a measure of this Sirsik index and use that as a proxy for morphology. So we're dividing up things in disky galaxies and spheroidal galaxies based on their light distribution. And these are the results that we get. So remember the five slices. So they occur here. So this is the Large Magellanic Cloud slice. This is a little more massive, more massive, more massive. And this is up to about Milky Way mass at redshift 0. So what are we plotting here? Well, we're plotting redshift on the y-axis and Sirsik index on the x-axis here. So things that are around 1 would be disk galaxies. Things that are around 4 are elliptical galaxies. And I put a dividing line at the Sirsik index of 2.5. And all the little red dots are all the galaxies. And you can see that it's spread all over the place. But if you do take the median value in small redshift intervals here, you'll find that they are actually systematically giving preference for certain Sirsik values. And for this Large Magellanic Cloud type galaxy, it just doesn't change very much with redshift or with time. For these galaxies, it goes back to redshift of 3, which is about 11 billion years ago. So it's actually quite far back in time. For the more massive one, we can go out to redshift of 4 because they are more massive, so they're brighter. We can more easily see them. And redshift of 4, that's 12 billion years approximately. And then what happens is we see that they all start out as Sirsik index 1. So they are disk-like galaxies with a typical galaxy of that slice, that mass slice, is a disk galaxy at high redshift. And then they start changing. And they start changing more rapidly or earlier the more massive the galaxy is. So here's a summary of these lines. So here the red one is the Large Magellanic Cloud type that just goes down here. Here is the Milky Way galaxy. It starts changing to here. So what this shows is that the galaxies that we see today, and remember I said that 75% of all the stars in the local universe are in elliptical galaxies. That doesn't mean that they've always been in elliptical galaxies. Galaxies didn't form monolithically like Egg and Lindenbell and Sandage proposed in 1962. It is a more complex process, but whatever the process is, and that we're still not sure about, it produces these spheroidal galaxies, but in a fairly orderly fashion. We can also use these slices to look at the star formation properties. I'm not going to go in this in detail because it would take too much time. And it's a little more complicated because things change with cosmic time. And if you want to look for variations, it gets complicated. But the bottom line is that they all start out forming stars like the typical galaxies do at high redshift. And then they start dropping off at lower redshift and become quite quiescent. So this is summarized in this. And again, the drop-off in star formation activity occurs much, much earlier, already out at more than 10 billion years. ago for the most massive type of galaxy like the Milky Way, although it didn't happen for the Milky Way. And this has been known for quite some time, and it's known as the downsizing effect. The interesting thing here is that the same thing occurs for the morphology of the galaxy, and they seem to follow each other. In fact, the star formation rate seems to precede the change in morphology a little bit. And although this doesn't say anything about what the processes are that determines this, it does put limits on the type of processes that have been proposed to be responsible for, one, the change in morphology, and two, the change in the star formation activity. This is just the same plot, but now instead of redshift, we plot this in cosmic time or look-back time, and you can see how nonlinear the redshift and time is here. And now it's very stark that how quickly, how early in time things started to change for the more massive ones, whereas for the least massive ones, they don't change at all. So that was one study we did. We also used the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, or ALMA, to study the evolution of the gas fraction of galaxies as a function of redshift. And again, we picked one of these slices. We took the most massive one because that means that things are easier to detect. More massive, the more of everything you have. And the idea here is that, remember the illustrious simulation, that you start out with 0% stars and the star, but then the amount of stars grow with time, whereas you don't introduce new gas in this cube, it's constant. So you're basically converting gas into stars as a function of time. So galaxies that are out here should at high redshift should have a much higher gas fraction than galaxies in our local universe. And here are just some examples of the data that we got. And the images here are Hubble images. These were candles, galaxies. We had lots of different filters. You can see again that a galaxy that is very, very faint in these wavelengths and then becomes strong once you get into the near infrared. So you have a kind of a break, and that applies to pretty much to these, not so much this one, just a little bit. And then here we have the ALMA map that we got from these three galaxies. We have a total of 70 galaxies. And we detected most of them, but there were also some non-detections that were quite interesting. And again, this is something that has been going on, not as long as this first plot that I showed you, but at least for 10, maybe 15 years, people have been trying to do this, pushing to higher redshifts. And this is a plot from, we published this last year and collected all the measurements that we could find in the literature over the last 10 years and came up with this one. The interesting thing here, so this is the gas fraction. So one means that you're entirely, a galaxy consists only of gas, and zero, it consists only of stars. And then we have redshift going out to redshift of five. So the interesting thing is in the local universe, the typical galaxy has about 10% of its mass in gas, in interstellar gas. That's its current reservoir of that it can use to form stars if no gas flows in from the outside. And the models, so this thin black line here, depicts a model prediction how this should evolve with redshift or evolve with time. And this actually predicts that we will get up to between 80 and 90% at redshift of five. So the galaxy should be mainly gaseous. And in fact, the breaking line is here 0.5, of course. Our data are these red dots we find for redshift two, redshift three. We are consistent with the theoretical predictions and consistent with most other attempts to do this. I should say that this is a very, very difficult thing to measure, because ideally we should just observe the H1, the 21 centimeter line. But unfortunately, the 21 centimeter line, or 1.4 gigahertz, is very close to frequencies that are used for things like cell phones, microwave, TV signals, and things like that. And there is a protected band around 21 centimeter for radio astronomy, but it's so narrow that if we try to observe things that are even in our local universe, we start picking up TV stations and whatnot. So it's completely, the astronomical signal completely drowns out in that. So there's very, very difficult to basically impossible currently to observe the 21 centimeter signal to get the amount of gas in a galaxy. And instead we have to rely on other tracers that are much fainter, requires more time, or are indirect and things like that. So it is a very tricky observation. The one thing that surprised us with this is that when we had a sample of galaxies out at four and redshift 4 and 5, and we actually didn't detect any of these. The interesting thing with our study was that since we did use this slice in redshift stellar mass space, our only selection criteria was redshift and stellar mass. We didn't select it to be particularly massive, or in fact, our difficulties get bigger and bigger the further up we go, because we're picking smaller galaxies. We didn't pick galaxies that we think would have gas and so on. So our selection criteria was very pure. And still, we didn't detect a single one, and the limits are quite severe. And we're still not quite sure what's going on there, because if we look at their properties in our sample, compare them with this plot. This is the star formation plot that I didn't go into detail, but this is for that mass slice where we picked our ALMA galaxies. And we overlaid the ones that were detected and the ones that were not detected. They are where they should be. There's nothing that's sticking out and saying, aha, we didn't find any gas in these galaxies, because they seem to be just normal. So we're still trying to figure out what's going on here. But I think it's a methodology to select galaxies without biases to study evolutionary effects that is very very fruitful, actually. So I have a couple of more slides. I don't know. I think I'm running out of time here. So if the moderator would like to break off here, that's fine with me. Or if I have
continue, please.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So I just wanted to mention there is another angle on this that we are pursuing right now, and that is, even if you can identify these galaxies at high redshift and pick the ones that are the progenitors of a given galaxy and study evolution and things like that, it's still very difficult to look at the detailed properties, what's going on a small scale, what is driving the star formation and things like that. But there is one other group of galaxies that I didn't mention when we talked about Hubble's fork diagram, and he actually didn't include it initially, and those are dwarf irregular galaxies, and to be more specific, what's known as blue compact dwarf galaxies. So these are galaxies in the local universe that are look like this, pretty much. This is known as the bare paw galaxy. Some people think it's an interacting galaxy, but there are no indications that this is an interacting galaxy. It seems to be just a very tiny galaxy where star formation is popping up in clumps. It could be that these are analogous to high redshift galaxies. and just to the right here. So these are ground-based Sloan Digital Sky Survey images of two other of these type of dwarf galaxies. And you see, if you're looking at the ground-based, it looks like three clumps pretty much. If you're looking at this with the HST, it starts breaking up in individual star-forming regions. So they do look. These are the type that you see at high redshift, like in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, and maybe they are actually consisting of individual star-forming regions like this. So here is one example: is an HST image two, it's Markarian 930. So they have low stellar mass, like the high redshift galaxies we've been looking at. They have a high dark matter content, and they have a high gas fraction. In fact, the gas fraction are about as high as the ones we find at redshift 3, which is almost between 60 and 70% of the total mass is in gas. They have a low metallicity, remember anything that is not hydrogen or helium, and it's about a 10,000th of a solar in some cases. It's not 10,000 solar, it's over H is 10 to the minus 4. This is about 0.1 to 0.2 solar, so it's a tenth of a solar. They have high star formation rates for their mass, they actually could be local analogs of galaxies in the early universe. And right now, I have a grad student, Scarlett Martino. She's studying these galaxies. She has a sample of 11 of them that she's looking into details. She's flown with Sophia to get the data. And so stay tuned for what's coming out of this. This is one example of Scarlett's results. This is a dust continuum emission in this Bear Paw galaxy. And we're trying to figure out what's going on here. It's clear that this region, which is forming stars, do have a lot of dust emission, but we also found dust emission in this one, which doesn't seem to have any activity right now. And the question is it past its activity when this is a remnant, or is this just where the next sort of popcorn is gonna go off in this galaxy and so on? That we don't know yet. So to summarize here, that galaxies in the early universe, they consist of more gas than stars. Their gas fraction is more than 50% typically, maybe even 60 and 70, it depends on the redshift. They have irregular morphologies, but the light distribution seems to be disk-like, so that's exponential, which is a bit surprising, but that's what came out of our study. And they are rapidly transforming gas into stars. Galaxies in the local universe, though, they are what I would call morphologically evolved. They are beautiful spiral galaxies or beautiful elliptical galaxies. And most of the stars resides in giant elliptical galaxies because most of the stars that are in these high redshift galaxies will morphologically evolve into spheroidal galaxies. The gas content is very low, about 10% for in the local universe, and this is for spiral galaxies. Elliptical galaxies is even lower. And the star formation activity itself is lower by a factor of 10 to 20 compared with the peak activity. So if you think about it, if you would have lived at redshift 1 or redshift 2, the sky would have been absolutely ablaze with star formation, both in our galaxy and all the surrounding galaxies. And right now that has decreased by a factor of almost a 20. So we are really in a universe where the activities is slowly decreasing. And then we use this to start with method that I mentioned to pick galaxies without a bias to do study morphological transformation, star formation. And we believe that our interpretation of this result is that since both the transformation of morphology and the transformation of star formation follows the same path, there should be similar physical processes at work irrespective of stellar mass. Because if you think of it, something that transforms the morphology of a galaxy isn't necessarily something that stops the star formation and vice versa, but it has to be something that does both. And do we have two processes or do we have one process? And we're not sure quite yet about that. And I'll stop there. I'm sorry about having run over time. And I'll be happy to take questions.
So thank you. I would say that if you have questions, go ahead and make your video visible so that we kind of are aware that you have a question. And then we can call on you and you can unmute yourself. Go ahead, Guy.
Ask, please.
Gotta unmute yourself. Guy, unmute.
Yeah, okay. Wait a sec. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So you had a beautiful simulation of both the dark matter and gas temperatures over time. There's this thing in a cube rotating. Was, I think you said, about 15 million parsecs on a side or something like that. And there were these interesting bubbles that were coming out. And I was wondering, are those bubbles actually supernovae heating up that much of the neighboring interstellar medium? I'm just curious.
Right. No, it's a good question. Yeah, it's some of the small, on a smaller scale, it can be supernovae that can do this, but the main contributor to the heating of the gas around there is active galactic nuclei.
Okay.
And if one looks at it over and over again and compare it with this curve of star formation rate density, which mimics the activity of active galactic nuclei quite well, you would see that at around redshift of one or between redshift 2 and 1, these bubbles really come off quite a lot, and they heat the gas. I should say that so to answer your question, the heat mechanism is mainly through AGN and mainly through large AGNs like quasars and what's known as the radio mode, when they have big jets that go out and heat the intergalactic gas.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? You can raise your hand. Blank, you can make yourself visible. Any other questions?
If I could add something to the previous question there. So I should mention also that these feedback mechanisms are absolutely needed, because if we didn't have them in place, we would produce too many stars, or the models would produce too many stars. So it's a way of creating the variety of the stellar masses these tails. At that point, you need to shut off the star formation. Okay.
Any other questions? Harold?
No, this was a beautiful talk. It's a shame we can't go out and now look at the sky at the University of Maryland. We look forward to all being vaccinated and getting back to more normal times.
Well, I can agree with that.
Definitely.
Thank you very much, Tommy. It looks like your graduate students are doing very interesting work too with Sophia.
Yeah, she is. And I shouldn't say anything. This is still work very much in progress, but it does look like they do have properties that are more similar to the high redshift ones when it comes to the far infrared star formation and things than to local spiral galaxies. Whether that means that they are analogs or not, that is still to be determined, but we're working on it. She should have some answers in a year or so.
Very interesting.
Well, there are no other questions. Then I guess the meeting is done. We look forward to hopefully seeing you again at the October meeting, which is 10th October. John, do you have the information for who the next speaker is?
I'm not sure his microphone is working.
Hang on.
He wasn't able to introduce the speaker like he usually does. Let's
try again.
John, can you tell us anything?
Hey, John, we can't hear you. Something is wrong with your system, so we can't hear you.
Yeah, it indicates that it's on, but we don't hear anything. Elizabeth, we can hear. Guy, we can hear. Me,
John,
we can hear.
I think you might just need to turn up the volume. I heard you a little tiny bit. Try that if possible.
Well, I think he needs to do something with where his microphone is. He's not actually
near your mouth.
Yeah. So anyway, okay. Let's see, where do we have that information quickly?
Yeah, I think it's already on.
It's on the website. So the next speaker is Michael Walter from Carnegie.
Yeah.
About deep water and planetary evolution. So we thank everyone for attending tonight, and we will see you next month, 10th October. If you've registered for it, you should get a reminder email shortly before the meeting, just like you hopefully did for tonight.
I did.
So see you then.
Guy has his hand raised.
Yeah, hi, can
Elizabeth,
you hear me?
Go ahead, Guy.
Elizabeth, this is for...
Go ahead.
Guy?
Yeah, who's speaking?
Jim, this is... Just have a general question. I had a lot of trouble with the voice and video dropping out. Was that general or just me?
Just you.
Just you.
Fine with me. The only person that ever sounded peculiar was Jack when he... before the meeting when he sounded like he was on helium.
All right. Well, there must be something on my end then. Okay.
Okay. I had just a little announcement. I run the telescope making workshop, and we still don't know when people can actually go into the Chevy Chase Community Center and start that back up. But I think it'll be actually fairly soon. But I don't know that for a fact. That's it.
Elizabeth, could you email us where the recording will be?
It'll be posted to the website. It has to process after we end the meeting, and then I'll get it linked on the website.
We are so lucky to have you as our host.
And we'll have an attendance, sort of an attendance list. So if there's any teachers want to know which of their students were online, just drop me an email and I can let you know.
Right. I might want to know that all. They don't get any credit unless they actually write at least a one-page paper.
All right. Then if there's no other questions, I want to thank Tommy again. Awesome talk.
And my pleasure.
We look forward to seeing everyone next month. Bye.
Very
good. Thank you, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye, Marjorie.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. I'm departing, too.
All right. Take care, Harold.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Todd. What's going on?
Nothing much. How about with you?
Kind of quarantining at the house and condo in Alexandria.
Oh, okay. You went back there?
So. Yeah, I've been here since we got back from Colorado. Jerry was here for 2 weeks, and he's gone back to his mom's in McLean. And with classes and things, if I get called, like I got called to campus on Thursday evening, and kind of had to show up real quick. And so went out and did a little bit of work. But since it's a little bit iffy about me running into people and stuff, I'm just trying to stay away from my mother-in-law.
Yeah.
So, and then, of course, classes kind of, they're starting back up. The few in-person classes that they do have scheduled, those are starting up this week. And so we'll start holding the labs that we're scheduled to hold.
Oh, good. Yeah, Gymkhana is starting up virtually. They have to work out, they're working out using these type of meetings. So
okay.
We'll see how that goes.
Okay.
How's everybody else doing? John?
So y'all are welcome to head out. I'm going to, oh, let me, I know, I need to turn that off.
Okay.